When something happens to your car, you might say,
"No!" My car!
But what you really need to say is something that can actually help.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And just like that, State Farm is there to help you file your claim right on the State Farm mobile app. So, just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey folks, I'm Mark. It's the Unsung Podcast. And you are?
I'm the social outcast.
The social outcast.
An REM fan.
REM fan. Chris.
Welcome to the most controversial music podcast on the internet.
So before we dive in it, to give some context for that, if you have no idea what you're talking about, we put a couple of polls up on Instagram and Twitter asking if REM are the most divisive band that we have ever covered on the podcast, and there was three answers. Yes, no, and fuck off. Guess which one? Guess which one was the most popular?
We've covered black metal and neo-Nazis. We've covered
Ace of Base,
more Nazis, allegedly.
Once and former.
We've covered a lot of things that were thorny issues in this show. Who'd have thunk that REM would bring the most heat down on us?
Quite indeed divisive. It's odd, isn't it? Because it's...
Yeah, I mean, by divisive, as I pointed out, it's dividing me and the majority of other people, apparently.
I think it's weird, but like we did say, and some people have also commented as well, that it's a generational thing. I think that is proven to be true, given what all the people who's like, I don't mind them or I like them are like probably maybe even actually a bit older than you.
if that's possible.
Chris isn't as very well known as being one of the oldest men that has ever lived.
As I also mentioned on our AAA Unsung members area, which you can access if you subscribe to the podcast,
patreon.com/unsungpod.
Yeah, you also get ad free episodes, you get bonus stuff. There's loads of perks. One of them is that you're able to sling mud at us directly. This is where I took a large amount of heat. But I did make the point, and I've kept my powder fairly dry. And genuinely, this is not aimed at you.
I know, because I don't listen to indie music.
Yeah, but we have co-hosts on this show that listen to some of the most wash stuff I've ever heard in my life. And I'm taking grief for liking REM. I mean, the nerve of some people.
Yeah, it's pretty redneck, like.
Couldn't paint a redneck in they folk. Honestly, you couldn't. But I stand by it. I mean, I think I made that case I know I made it in detail because it was 4 hours long. I know I made that case. It was a nuanced case. It was thoughtful. I did acknowledge that it's not as good as I remember, but I did also, you know, try and get people to face up to the fact that sometimes we have preconceptions about musicians, and we almost like dig our heels in. We're like, I'm not changing this. I'm just not changing this. This is fundamental to how I... And it's like, well, but what if it's not right? And that's what that episode was about. We just try to like move the needle a wee bit on people. And I think actually with you, we moved the needle a wee bit. I think that was commendable. It was like, right, I'm not under any illusions that you're a big REM fan, but you were like, no, I kind of get it now. I get the phases were different. I get there's an age thing. And I get that there are definitely some amazing examples of music in a big catalogue, which unavoidably has a lot of filler, you know. So I'm kind of happy with that, you know. Bring it. Just bring it. But I can't remember that phrase, slings and arrows, Shakespearean Except, but you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Come at me.
Come at him.
Yeah. And if you want to come at me, subscribe to the podcast and fucking come at me then. Right?
You relish the challenge.
Yeah. So I passed the baton to Mark for this week. Mm-hmm. And Mark, you have chosen to cover.
The album's called Excavation and the artist is the Haxan Cloak.
Can I just say this is going to be the weirdest sample cutting that I've ever done in this show.
It's kind of pointless, to be honest, man. It's like trying to cut in Sun or something.
Yeah, you know? I usually cut in 15-second samples. What the fuck am I achieving with the accent?
Well, I suppose you could cut in a soundtrack thing, but I suppose that's solo, isn't it? But I was going to ask you a question. Like, how has your existential dread been this week?
Heightened.
Yeah, it's fairly fucking oppressive stuff.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, we did at the start of the REM thing talk about those episodes whereby we undertake a particularly arduous period of research. The research obviously includes listening to their back catalogue. There's not many that are more dense or oppressive or you know, mood altering than the Haxan Cloak. It's not something you can just slam on.
It definitely is not.
It really changes your afternoon though.
It changes a lot about you as a person.
Out for a cup of coffee, see someone you like, but you're listening to the Haxan Cloak and everything feels like you've got cancer.
You're in a horror film
ending.
It's impregnable. It's dense. It's arduous is a good way of describing it. And usually when we say that, I mean, maybe for you, you might think it's because it's been really tough and just not fun. Haxan Cloak is tough, not fun and arduous, but that's the whole fucking point of it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. This week we're doing the excavation by the Haxan Cloak. The Haxan Cloak is a one-man artist, Bobby Krillick. And I guess in this episode we'll go through some of his records.
Strange second name. He's of Serbian descent, right?
Yeah, he is of Serbian descent. That's correct.
So can I just point out, Haxan is Swedish for witch, and I'm going to Sweden in 2 days.
Going to Sweden, yeah. Yes. Bork, bork, bork.
I didn't really understand what that was until you sent me the link to the
Swedish
meat
bars. An all-time classic.
I know we've got some listeners from Sweden. I'm going to Stockholm, so give me a wave.
You'll be the one with the black cloud over his head.
Yeah, totally. I was also informed by my Swedish colleague that Stockholm is the Edinburgh of Sweden.
Oh.
And that I shouldn't have chosen to go there. So
is it Malmo? Is that the Glasgow?
Yeah, they're from Malmo.
Yeah.
There's also Gothenburg, which is quite different. But hey, this is my first time, so I'm just looking forward to it.
Malmo is, you can get to Copenhagen from Malmo, there's a bridge between them both.
Yes, I know, and there's a very famous TV show about that bridge.
Yeah.
I'm also looking forward to some stinky fish.
Yeah.
How do you say stinky fish?
Is the dish you're talking about is called Storm something, I think. It's like in a can, fermented.
I'll know in 4 days.
You'll hate it.
Yeah, I'll bring it up next week. Maybe in multiple senses.
Presumably so, yeah.
Anyway, you know, tell us a bit about this guy. I don't know a lot.
So, Haxan Cloak has released two records. Two full-length records.
Albums of his stuff.
As in, under the name Haxan Cloak. So, well, I mean, let's disambiguate that a little bit. The Haxan Cloak, as we've said, is Bobby Krillick. Bobby Krillick has since stop doing the Haxan Cloak, it appears, mostly.
Well, no, because he just released a single,
but he's mostly, but it's the first thing he's released in 11 years. And he kind of moved into movie soundtracks.
Under his own name.
Which does make a great deal of sense, and we will get to that very soon, I guess. But so he's released two records under the name Haxan Cloak. The first one, self-titled, 2011, and then the second one, this one, Excavation, 2013. They are of a piece together. They literally run into one another, both the albums. The way the first one ends is how the second one begins, and they have a loose narrative. I don't know if you know about this.
I do know about this.
So the first album is about a guy that is dying. and the second one's about what happens in the afterlife. And he is on record as saying he's fucking terrified of dying, and he decided to write two concept albums around it. But they have no vocals, so the concept is very loose. But yeah, it's pretty cool stuff, I think. Arty and experimental.
There are some EPs and isolated releases as well. There was the self-titled EP in 2009, which is only available on CDR, and now on the internet. There was Observatory, it's a single, in 2011. Mm-hmm. There was The Men Partied the Sea to Devour the Water, which is a fairly sort of celebrated EP in 2012. And then there was the single NY last year.
Yeah, towards the end of last year, November, I think it was 2023.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty up for taking a little tour through that discography because I listened to it, so I might as well use that knowledge of Suffering. Suffering and Hellraiser analogies are probably quite applicable this week. But I do want to point out that for this episode, I maintained objectivity despite the fact that Hacksaw and Cloak worked with Health, and that is a sign of questionable judgment at best.
Oh, he did produce one track on our second album. Was it Death Magic? It was just one song, basically.
Shouldn't.
I think it's an intro. I think it's like an intro or like a really short song, and it does sound like Hacksaw and Cloak.
Yeah, he's done a few significant production jobs. He did stuff for Björk.
Björk.
And he did The Body.
That record by The Body is very good and may actually come up on the podcast one day. I Shall Die Here.
All right, but not on this one.
On this one.
Okay.
No, I mean, but as a record in and of itself.
For the record, I don't really care about The Body as a band. It was okay. You could definitely hear his production chops loud and clear. In a different way from the way you might, for example, like when Josh Homme did Arctic Monkeys, the record sounded like one of his records, but their songs. And when, I don't know, let's say Kurt Ballou does something for a sort of similar sounding band, it has tonal similarities, but yet the music is still essentially whatever he was recording. Right? Whereas I feel like The Body record, the Hacksaw and Cloak, sounds like a little bit more than just a producer engineer on it. There's bits of it where it sounds like it's made a material difference to the music on the record.
That's interesting.
And as I said, I'm not a Body fan, so I was neither pleasantly surprised nor disappointed. I had no dog in that fight. I thought it was totally unremarkable, but I would have said that about them anyway, so that doesn't really reflect on him.
And then he's also done some production work for Gofrap. I didn't listen to the record because I don't like Goldfrapp. Did you listen to it?
No, I don't particularly care about Goldfrapp either. Oh, well, in saying that, I mean, I think I shouldn't say that. I mean, I respect Goldfrapp. I don't listen to them, but I think it's like a really interesting project, and the environment in which it thrived, it really stood out at the time, and it's kind of endured pretty well as well. Like, Goldfrapp's really acquired a bit of a kind of cult status, and so I can also see why they might want to work with them. Because he brings like a kind of new production technique to stuff that maybe needed an injection of something fresh. I would probably listen to that, actually. Like I said, I don't sit and listen to Goldfrapp, but that's not because I particularly hate them. It's just not music I spend a lot of time with. But I kind of get it with him.
Yeah. And then he's also worked with Serpent With Feet.
Can do without the four ethers.
Yes.
Lost Under Heaven wife as well.
Yeah. Wife's all caps.
Yeah, wife's quite interesting. I haven't listened to it, but the guy used to be in Altar of Plagues. Have you ever heard them?
Yeah.
James Kelly sort of left that band and did his own thing. It's too far to see from a place on my own. It's something that's vaguely similar to Hex and Cloak, you know, like one man electronica, quite dark, you know.
So Serpent with Feet is on Triangle, which is the label really that we'll end up talking about. Our friend of the pod, Ben Power, introduced me to some of the acts in that label. Serpent with Feet was good. Vessel, who we'll mention as we go through here, was particularly good and remains my favourite on that label. So I owe Ben a thanks for bringing them to my attention some time ago. And that was also when I first heard Hex and Cloak. Mm-hmm. Will we take a wee tour through the back cat?
Yeah, let's do that.
Hex and Cloak EP, as I said, it was on CDR, really, back in the day, 2009, self-released. This was an era when he was really building most of his stuff around strings, like sampling and playing them and then modulating them quite a bit. It's very much doom drone. Mm-hmm. I've seen it listed as folk drone, which I think is really kind of quite appropriate. The second track in it, The Splintered Wind, is just ultra minimalist, but I think in a different way to the later electronic output. It's a hard thing to quantify, right? It's sparse, but it's not sparse in a way where it feels like something's missing. And I know the later electronic stuff, it claims to have been more conveying a narrative, and so things are missing for a reason. That early stuff, it just seems like that's his sensibility. Yeah. I don't mind it. The third track on that is just called Live Excerpt from Shunt 2009, which I assume was a live show or a mini festival or something. And for the first few minutes of that track, I think it's actually extremely effective. It's built around this sort of bagpipe-esque drone with multiple layers and textures, some really effective backward sampling as well, and it totally justifies that folk drone label. Only thing is that track does get pretty tedious, as for some reason he starts to extract the more interesting elements, and it ultimately just gives way to this really incessant mid-range drone that's somewhere between a string and a bagpipe, and it just gets a little dull.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really just like fucking about with some filters, and you're like, I don't really get what's happening now. But it starts really, really well. He followed that with an actual release, Observatory, as a single in 2011. The title track on this, the first track, is rhythmic, really percussive. It really reminds me of the aforementioned Vessel, especially the Punish Honey album, and that's a step up for me, albeit this was actually released a good year before Vessel's first record, Order of Noise, and probably about 3 years before Punish Honey. So, I mean, I think at this point Vessel was a project, but I think he was only putting out, you mm-hmm. know, the odd single. I say he, they, I'm not sure how Vessel identifies, but to be fair, perhaps Vessel took their cues from this rather than anything else, but they are the best cues, in my opinion. The second track in it is called Hounfur, or Hounfur, mm-hmm. Brackets Temple. It's this really low-key electronic atmospheric thing that builds really subtly, and it ends with this weirdly blissed-out euphoric pad. It's pretty solid. Mm-hmm. It's quite abstract without being pretentious. Like, I get the feeling that that track in particular, it has similarities with some of the later stuff, but it feels willing to work to maintain your attention. You know, as yeah. the track evolves, it has a sense of, I should do something now because I've been doing this for a while, and if I do something now, people will re-engage, and it feels like it plays the game a little bit, and just frankly, I think that works.
Mm-hmm.
Here's to the best spring ever in this season's must-have shoes. Find all the styles you need from brands you love at amazing prices right now at DSW. Update your closet with colorful sandals made for sunny days, fresh sneakers perfect for spring looks, and sporty soles ready for new adventures. Whatever you're up to this spring, DSW has the exact right pair for the occasion. Shop must-have spring shoes at your DSW store and DSW.com.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha Evolocumab is right for you. With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Then we get to the debut album. Can I just ask, you know, to try and get to the root of the kind of introduction bias that we talk about in the show quite a lot, where, you know, we all almost always end up with a slightly more favourable perception of the record that we first encounter in an album's, in an artist's catalogue. What did you listen to first by Hacks and
Coal? It was Excavation that I listened to first.
Right.
I think at the time it came out, well, I guess maybe 2014. Basically, I was looking for a bunch of new stuff to listen to, and I was just looking through end of year lists, and I probably listened to a lot of things that were on that, but nothing really stuck with me beyond the stuff I usually like. But there was something about Excavation that really drew me in, and then going back to listen to this first record, I was like, I can see how this is the same artist, but it's not, it doesn't really have the things which I found quite enthralling about Excavation. I didn't really find him on the self-titled record. Still a good record, I think, but it wasn't for me as compelling.
Thank you. I think I can understand that. I think you are a big fan of hip hop. When I think of your music tastes, I think you are quite mindful of production. I think, you know, all the way from like J Dilla, Run the Jewels, to some of the more kind of esoteric stuff that we've done. I think you pay quite a lot of attention to beats, to sub, all those kind of things. For whatever reason, that's not as much on my radar. So I can understand how you would get into an artist that has such a reputation for production. I noticed actually in a lot of forums, people talking about Hacks and Cloak, like people who are engineers, saying that he has amongst the best natural talent they've ever heard for with regards to the clarity and definition of extremely low end tones.
Definitely.
Yeah. His work with the bass on albums is just brilliant.
Like, yeah, I think this when I think about Excavation, I think to myself, the venue you would need to be able to play some of that stuff in has to be seriously kitted out.
You need a good sound system, but he seems very, very adept at that stuff. And frankly, when you're making music, just because of the bias of the human ear, some people just tend to not be as good. And it also takes good equipment to control sub and things like that. So this first LP, I can appreciate as well why you might not be as drawn to it, because it's not as modern sounding. Not nearly as electronic as Excavation.
It's much more organic feeling as well.
Yeah, so again, yeah, a bit like that opening EP, it was built around field recordings, sampled sounds, a lot of string work. I think he was playing, you know, stringed
instruments.
He played
a lot of the stringed instruments on it.
In a shed or something like that.
Yeah, in his parents' shed at the bottom of the garden. Yeah.
It's also, a lot of that string work's really modulated. And I think as an aesthetic experience, it's pretty impressive in that sense. To me, I mean, we know that this guy does eventually go into soundtracking. This quite often sounds less like a coherent album than it does a portfolio kind of pitching for film work.
It's
very dark. I mean, I hesitate to even say that because that's such an obvious thing to say as soon as you hear this.
That word's going to become meaningless quite quickly.
It's so redundant, yeah. The first track in it, Raven's Lament, suitably sinister droning strings at the start. I will say there's a really cringy xylophone that comes in about 2:40.
Yeah, it's really creepy, which kind of makes me go, ah.
But the thing is, I think it feels to me like it's trying too hard to be unnerving. You know, it reminded me of, you know, in crap horror films when you suddenly hear a creepy kid's voice, look behind you, Gabriel. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Or, you know, that effect they used to do in horror films where someone's like a ghost's face would twitch, like, mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, it was very in vogue for about 5 years. Uh-huh. They would go, oh, and they would move in this really unnatural way very quickly.
A jerking.
Yeah, like that glockenspiel or xylophone, actually, I think it is. It's just too cheesy. It's like, oh, look, he's trying to be creepy. Mm-hmm. It really jars with me. And I think it's a bit of a naive decision that he probably wouldn't make now. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
I think so, yeah.
By the time he does the second album, I don't think he's doing anything as twee as that.
Mm. I think that first track, though, really portends to some of the film. You're right, it's like a portfolio. And Raven's Lament. The way the strings are deployed in it is something which she kind of later comes back to in like the Midsummer soundtrack, but he does it in a much more refined way with a lot more finesse, you know. So you can hear the ear is definitely there, and the sensibility is certainly there.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that for a guy who is known for electronic and production, that a lot of, like, he's also just adept at manipulating strings and making them sound uncanny.
Well, one of the best examples of that is the fourth track, Disorder.
Yeah,
It's a really good song.
It's the musical highlight, I think. It starts with a sort of folk drone that informs the coldest bits of False Lancome.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Uh-huh.
I think some of Lancome's appeal, as we know, lies in their ability to sort of straddle the spaces between powerfully hip acts and fan bases like Godspeed, like Sun, and now like Hacks and Cloak. They have a kind of appeal across those lines. You see, you go to their shows and you see the most bizarre array of t-shirts.
But Dave, I met Dave a few weeks ago, last week, and he was at a Lancome gig, and that's what he was saying. He's like, you could be standing next to a crusty punk guy and a black metal guy on the other side, and then you've got all these people like folk music, like old folk punks and stuff. It's and totally bizarre.
Yeah, and that's why listening to this era, the Hacks and Cloak, hearing similarities and how people could definitely make that jump as well. You can hear a lot of the deeper cuts from Constellation Records on here as well, bands like Exhaust and Hanged Up and things like that. Folk horror is a good tag for this style of music. The creaking, clanking woodshed noises are kind of equal parts Evil Dead, maybe Evil Dead 2, and you know that track What's He Building In There by Tom Waits?
What's He Building In There?
Yeah.
Someone moaning low. I keep seeing the blue light of a TV show. He has a router and a table saw, and you won't believe him.
Yeah.
And they're effective, but the thing is that Tom Waits track was always a novelty to me.
Totally, it is.
And frequently this record feels a bit novelty. Like the third track, Burning Torches of Despair, is undeniably like technically impressive, but comes across as a bit of theatre to me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really come across as like a musical endeavour.
Yeah. Can I just point out the growing on that, on the first album, sorry, because that starts to bring in the electronics and it kind of foreshadows what's going to come. They're still strings, but they're processed in such a way that they kind of feel like they're under a layer of grime and distortion, which again is something that he does in Places and Excavation. And there's also some trip poppy kind of percussion that comes in during that song, around 5 minutes as well. Which would actually make sense as to why somebody like Goldfrapp might want to work with them, and vice versa, because of that, the way those kind of beats sound.
I mean, I did find myself warming to the first record, especially considering it was a first record, and the guy didn't yet have that blanket praise and genius status, de facto genius status thing. It's a cool idea, it's a brilliantly technically realised weird vision. It's ultimately a bunch of creepy noises and dark folk moods really quite beautifully grouped together on a collection.
Yeah.
The 2012 EP, The Men Parted the Sea to Devour the Water. Reasonably well thought of, I believe. One giant movement, but subdivided for those that are in the know. Different approaches and textures throughout. It's like really looping choral vocals that cloud the first 9.5 minutes. I like where the song goes from between that, from about the 9 minutes up until about 12 minutes. I really enjoy what it does, but then it shifts tone really awkwardly and I'm just not really convinced about the record from that point.
Mm-hmm.
There's these percussive textures at 15 minutes or 15 and a half minutes maybe that are great, like they sound amazing, but the track feels like it's lost its way a bit. Again, it blisses out at the end, but it feels very rote. Now, I mean, it's just a rote, blissy synth ending, and you're like, "Ah, oh, right, okay." So, 5 minutes of just euphoric, whatever. I didn't like the way that promising EP halfway just seemed like it came off the rails to me.
Mm. Yeah, it seems a bit clunky, I suppose. You know, I admire the desire to, that kind of rhymes, Sam. I admire the desire that to create a song, to create one long piece. And I don't think he's ever really, he's certainly never attempted anything of that length since. You can't really do that with soundtracks, obviously, but even in Excavation, the longest song's only 13 minutes long.
We'll get on to soundtracks.
Yeah. But it's, I think maybe that's probably a niche you needed to scratch.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I've heard these live sets and it does sound a bit like one of his live sets, just somewhat condensed. He did Excavation, obviously, 2013. And then 2015, he's done a lot of like bits and bobs of TV work, bits and bobs of soundtrack work. I've just dipped into some of them.
I've got a few as well.
First one is 2015 Black Hat.
Michael Mann film.
Chris Hemsworth
yeah. Plays a hacker.
He worked on this with Atticus Ross, and by any standards, that's a bit of a promotion.
Pretty much, yeah.
If you're at the point where you're getting invited onto projects by Atticus Ross, that's great. I'm not sure what he actually did on this soundtrack, because most of the composition was done by Harry Gregson Williams, and this is where we start to like bite into the reality of doing soundtracks. Okay, so I just know secondhand, admittedly, from a couple of friends who work in the industry and have gone into soundtracking, how fucking difficult it is. And it's not just in the sense of making it sound good, but what I mean is the fact that it is many, many cooks. Harry Gregson Williams on that soundtrack said that he was, quote, shocked and surprised at the music that appeared in the final film. I would like it to be known for what it's worth that the score for Black Hat may be credited to me, but contains almost none of my compositions. He went on to describe the quasi-emotional synth string pieces that had replaced his own work. I was not the author of most of what is now in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just one take on what I've heard pretty reliably as regards people putting together mixes, putting together first drafts, thinking this is actually sounding great, and then doing some fucking Skype call where there's like six random people that they're not even sure what they do in the production.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, yeah, can you take that out? Could you maybe do some piano here? Could you maybe, I don't think we need any percussion here. Oh, how about we add some percussion here? And then suddenly you've gone from being a chef being asked to prepare something delicious to someone saying, I'd really just like a hamburger. Mm-hmm. Could you go in and just make me a fucking hamburger, please? You know, well, why did you hire me if you just wanted a fucking hamburger? Well, you're here now. Could you just turn it into a hamburger, please? And that seems to be the reality. I mean, certainly, maybe once you're like powerful enough that you could force things through. I don't know what Trent Reznor's experience is of doing soundtracks, but it is way less glamorous than it seems. And I'm not sure. I've heard the same things about doing TV stuff. I'm not sure whether TV and film, one is better than the other, but I know there's a hell of a lot of people with an opinion that like to get involved, and I know that things go down to the wire and you suddenly get asked to change things at the last minute when you think you're done, and then it starts eating into your next project and eating into your next project and you're fucking losing sleep. And I know it's like a really difficult thing to do.
I know, to kind of bring up Trent Reznor, that was actually quite interesting, because one of the things that he found difficult when engineers is like writing songs and having something to say. And he's on record as saying, actually, there's an interview in 2023 where he actually says that one of the best things that he enjoys about doing soundtracks is working in service to something else. I imagine that you're probably right. At his level, there's probably not a lot of cooks coming in there to try and stir his pot, you know what I mean? But I think there's still necessarily quite a collaborative process with the filmmaker, you know, in order to create something which kind of meets their vision and also yours. When you get to that level, then they're hiring you because they like what they've heard already. They're probably not going to try and fuck around with it too much.
Well, I don't know if that's...
But I don't know.
I don't know if that's actually true, yeah, to be honest with you. But we'll come back to that in a second. So just before we go on to his next soundtrack that I wanted to bring up, we should mention Mouth Mantra by Björk. And it's exactly what I expected. Björk singing all the Björk notes you would expect her to sing. I mean, you know, I have to admit, this podcast did make me sort of like question how much I actually like Björk as well. But we'll come back to that. The vocal in this is remarkably submerged, and is backed by some quite raspy, loud in the mix, and quite sinister electro. The whole thing seems to owe a lot to Aphex Twin, though. When I was listening to it, it just really felt like someone was doing a version of Aphex Twin. I've no issue with the song, really. It's very, very stylish. I don't think it's great. I don't really give a fuck about Björk's vocal line on it. It's just so fucking Björk. I have heard this a million times. Like, I have heard Björk do Björk a million times. Anyway, I don't know why. That just got under my skin a wee bit. In that tune, there is a particularly nice bit around about 3:10. It's this really lush little faux orchestral break. It doesn't last long, but it's a nice little melodic payoff, given that the rest of the song isn't really that melodic.
Yeah.
It's just...
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
It's all right. Now, I don't know what other soundtracks you wanted to come to, but I really wanted to talk about Midsommar.
Of course. Why? How could you not talk about Midsommar?
So 2019, I mean, it's a breakout film for Ari Aster. You know, as much as I personally think Hereditary is a better movie, I think Midsommar's really good. Very stylish as well.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen Midsommar? It's good. One thing I'll say about Midsommar is I've not really had the inclination to go and rewatch it. As much as I enjoyed it, I actually saw it twice at the cinema, and then I expected I'd want to go back and see it again, but for whatever reason, I don't.
That's all right. Nothing wrong with that.
Aye and no. It's a wee bit like music. There's a bit of an analogy there for music, where some music is very impressive and you're like, I'd never want to hear it again. And you're like, well, was I impressed by the technical proficiency of it, or did I actually enjoy it? Or was it just so harrowing that I never want to see it again? But anyway, folk horror is the tag that I used for Hacksaw and Cloak, and folk horror is the tag for Midsommar, clearly.
Do you want to know a bit of trivia about this soundtrack?
Aye, hit me.
You may have read it, I don't know, but Ari Aster wrote the script for this to Excavation by the Hacksaw and Cloak. He was like, when I finished this script, there's only one person that wanted the soundtrack for it, and it was Bobby, obviously. And they approached him and said, look, I wrote this script to the soundtrack of Excavation, and now I really want you to do it. And apparently, like, Bobby felt quite a lot of pressure, because it's like, well, you've written it with me in mind, listen to my music and now I need to try and create something which is like that, but nothing like that, because a film isn't really about what that, that record's about. Well, you know what I mean?
The film's so, very sunny.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a, quite a unique challenge, but pretty cool to get the nod from the director, like, directly.
That yeah. answers a question that I was going to ask later on, so we'll come back to that. But this... You actually mentioned this earlier on. It's closer to the earlier stuff, you know, the self-titled record, given the preponderance of the strings on it.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned this, and I think it's a good point, when we're talking about the collaborative nature of doing a soundtrack. The music is dictated by the action.
Mm-hmm.
So whilst this is his score, he's not really at the wheel. He is soundtracking what is being decided by the film's mm-hmm. editors and production and direction. That means he's also kind of forced to get a move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really helps his material. I will say, going back to that, you know, the Gregson Williams experience, as we described in Black Hat, from watching it unfold, the painful amount of to and fro that takes place, you know, with directors and producers, these scores are, as I said, not the authored brilliance of one person.
Mm-hmm.
They are more like the compromise of many that is then realised by one.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby will probably have multiple other versions and approaches even lying on hard drives that will never be released, and to be honest, very probably versions that he prefers,
mm-hmm.
that the studio or the director or all of the above just were like, no, we want this one, and he'll be like, well, that's not the best one, but fuck it, whatever, I'm sick of doing this now. And that seems to be the reality for a lot of people doing soundtracking as well. The tracks in this, the third one, I think, like Halsingland, I don't know how you actually
Halsingland, yeah
mm-hmm. Tracks like that they're pretty meaningless without their visual context.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's not Survivor kicking out Eye of the Tiger. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't go away from the movie and be like, yeah!
Mm-hmm.
It's just fucking meaningless. It's like synchronized ambience with the odd jump scare,
mm-hmm.
you know, a tonal string jump scare thing. And I really struggle to have any meaningful listening experience with stuff like this as a result when there's not the visual cues alongside it. It's one of the analogies I thought of. It's like watching half a football match, and by half a football match I don't mean like the first or second half, I mean you can only see one team, so you're like, mm-hmm. Was that a good pass? Was that a bad pass? What were the other team doing when that happened? I wonder, like, you know,
there's
just a sort of like meaninglessness to it,
mm-hmm.
where you're just sort of like, I don't really know if that was a good way to soundtrack what was going on, because I don't know what the fuck was going on. The 12th track in it, Fire Temple, has way more plays than other stuff there, and it does stand up much more by itself.
Pretty epic and mournful and expansive, almost bombastic towards the end, and kind of vaguely joyful towards the end as well. It's an odd, all the things I just said there are quite contradictory, but that is all those things. I mean,
it's a long track. It's pleasant. It's kind of a symphonic workout. It's, you know what, it reminds me a bit of like Godspeed if they were soundtracking something in the 1940s, because it's something that there's something quite old timey and deliberately a little bit cliched about it. It has a really memorable flourish and route change at 6 minutes. It's got this really nice bit in it. But I feel like without the context of the movie listening to a soundtrack like this. All I'm really doing is trying to work out if this guy's technically proficient. Mm-hmm. And he is. I mean, I know he is. So I really don't really get what else there is to add. It's not what I would consider a good listening experience overall, because I'm just sort of like unmoored. Like, oh, well, okay, cool. That was a sinister bit. All right. And that was a noise. And that was a bassy noise. I just find it a very odd thing to listen to.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Given that it's not meant to flow musically.
Yeah, that's the thing that's quite interesting, I think, about a lot of soundtracks, is that taken in isolation, they can be a kind of a discombobulating listen, because you're like, oh, that sounds cool. But then it never really, a lot of the songs, quote unquote songs, never really stick around long enough for you to get into them. And there's a soundtrack which I liked because I liked the TV show Beef, which we can talk about in a little second, which is full of those little kind of snippets of cool ideas and music which work really well in the show but are so incidental in the show, it's like difficult to judge on its own.
But maybe in the back of such a big soundtrack, it was split for the episode there.
Yeah, because I want to talk about the Returnal soundtrack.
Yeah,
so.
I got a feeling you might. Yeah, we'll come back next week and we'll look at just a few more releases that he's been involved in. And we can maybe chew the fat about you know, soundtracking or the transition into soundtracking in general. But I'd also like to look at, you know, some of the context, because there's a few acts going back in time that he reminds me of, and I think they deserve a nod. So let's hold that back for the next episode.
Yeah, you can come back in probably about 5 minutes.
See you then.
See you then.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.